welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. We're deep in the month of May, which means sports fans are coming up to their annual drought. The end of the NBA playoffs are in sight, and football is so very far in the future. What's left? Baseball. I know for some sports fans, that's not enough. But if you're searching for ways to fill those Sunday afternoons or Monday night hours, here's the pitch. This week, I've assembled a roster of nonfiction titles that knock it out of the park. Together, we'll preview books that may help to get the conversation started about new ways to pursue your passions. And my guest today, Dave Barry, has put together some cogent thoughts on parenting, fashion, and the conundrum that is life today. It's all ahead as we turn to page one of the book report. First up at bat on today's book report is A Nice Little Place on the North Side, Wrigley Field at 100. Columnist George Will returns to baseball with a deeply personal look at his hapless Chicago Cubs and Wrigley Field as it turns 100 years old. Baseball, Will argues, is full of metaphors for life, religion, and happiness, and Wrigley is surely one of its sacred spaces. Winding beautifully like Wrigley's iconic ivory, Will's meditation on the friendly confines examines both the unforgettable stories that forged the field's legends and its larger-than-life characters who brought it glory, heartbreak, and scandal. In the end, you may find that this is more than a history of a ballpark. It's the story of Chicago, of baseball, and of America itself. Mark Deakins narrates.
Frost died in 1963, and this line is carved on the headstone of his grave in Bennington, Vermont. My lover's quarrel is less spacious than Frost's. Mine is with the Chicago National League Ball Club. The world is what it is and has been very good to me. The Cubs, however, are another matter. They have been generally disappointing and often annoying for most of my life, which began 47 days before Frost announced his quarrel. Why, then, have I, like many millions of similarly vexed and irritated fans, continued to love this team? There are, no doubt, many reasons. Or, because reason rarely regulates love, let us say there are many factors that explain the durability of my affection and that of others for the Cubs. Surely the most important ingredient in the chemistry of this peculiar loyalty is the place where the team has played its home games for a century. Wrigley Field really is a nice little place. Granted, few people would care about it if the Cubs did not play there. But a lot fewer people would care about the Cubs if they did not play there. What follows is a short stroll through the braided histories of the place and the team, both of which are facets of one of America's singular cities. I will begin with my beginning. I was born on Sunday morning, May 4th, 1941, in Champaign, Illinois. The Chicago Tribune that morning reported that on Saturday, the Cubs had been characteristically docile through the first five innings while losing to the Brooklyn Dodgers 4-3 in Ebbets Field. On Sunday, the Cubs crossed the East River and lost to the New York Giants 9-4. It was their third loss in a row. Had I been paying attention then, this book might not have been written. But one thing led to another, as things have a way of doing. And in 1948, when I was still not as discerning as one should be when making life-shaping decisions, I became a Cub fan. The Catholic Church thinks seven-year-olds have reached an age of reasoning. The Church might want to rethink that. The 1948 Cubs may have been the worst squad in the history of the franchise, finishing in eighth place, which in those days was last place, and 27.5 games out of first. The dreadful team inspired a Norman Rockwell cover on the September 4th Saturday Evening Post. Titled The Dugout, it featured a dejected and embarrassed Cubs dugout, behind which fans jeered. Their well-named manager was Charlie Grimm. He was, however, known as Jolly Cholly Grimm because he was so cheerful. Why was he? On August 30, 1948, the Cubs owner, Philip K. Wrigley, ran an ad in the Tribune, which 33 years later would buy the Cubs from Wrigley's estate, to apologize for the team. The ad told the unvarnished truth. This year's rebuilding job has been a flop. You might say that. The last place Cubs record was 64-90. The 1940s, my first decade, was the first losing decade the Cubs ever had. Since then, the Cubs have not had a winning decade. Since May 4, 1941, and through the 2013 season, they have lost 693 more games than they have won. What could compensate Cub fans for such a performance on the field? The field. Wrigley Field. This little book is about a little space. It is not, regardless of what some unhinged enthusiasts say, a sacred space. Wrigley Field's footprint on a city block is a tad smaller than that of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. The enthusiasts think the ballpark is a kind of cathedral, and that Wrigley Field is to baseball what Rome is, or was once said to be, to religion. All roads lead there, or should. This book is, in a sense, about a frame around a picture. The point of Wrigley Field is to display baseball games. People go to museums of fine art to see the paintings, not the frames that display them. Few people admire the pedestal more than the statue. Many people do, however, decide to go to Chicago Cubs games because they are played within this lovely frame.
We've just heard A Little Place on the North Side by George Will. Everyone is talking about this book. Its impact is so profound, investigations have begun. The book report brings you Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt by Michael Lewis, author of the blockbusters Liar's Poker, Moneyball, and Boomerang. Lewis returns to the financial world and gives listeners a ringside seat to one of the biggest news stories to hit Wall Street in years. If you aren't up to speed about high-frequency trading, you should be. Lewis sheds light on how it works and who benefits. Hint, not you. Dylan Baker narrates.
The workers were told only what they needed to know. They tunneled in small groups, apart from each other, with only a local sense of where the line was coming from or where it was going to. They were specifically not told of the line's purpose, to make sure they didn't reveal that purpose to others. All the time, people are asking us, "Is this top secret? Is it the government?" I just said, "Yeah," said one worker. The workers might not have known what the line was for, but they knew that it had enemies. They all knew to be alert to potential threats. If they saw anyone digging near the line, for instance, or noticed anyone asking a lot of questions about it, they were to report what they had seen immediately to the head office. Otherwise, they were to say as little as possible. If people asked them what they were doing, they were to say, "Just laying fiber." That usually ended the conversation, but if it didn't, it didn't really matter. The construction crews were as bewildered as anyone. They were used to digging tunnels that connected cities to other cities and people to other people. This line didn't connect anyone to anyone else. Its sole purpose, as far as they could see, was to be as straight as possible, even if that meant they had to rock saw through a mountain rather than take the obvious way around it. Why? Right up until the end, most workers didn't even ask the question. The country was flirting with another depression, and they were just happy for the work. As Dan Spivey said, "No one knew why. People began to make their reasons up." Spivey was the closest thing the workers had to an explanation for the line, or the bed they were digging for it. And Spivey was by nature tight-lipped, one of those circumspect Southerners with more thoughts than he cared to share. He'd been born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi, and on those rare occasions he spoke, he sounded as if he had never left, He'd just turned 40, but was still as lean as a teenager, with the face of a Walker Evans tenant farmer. After some unsatisfying years working as a stockbroker in Jackson, he had quit, as he put it, to do something more sporting. That turned out to be renting a seat on the Chicago Board Options Exchange and making markets for his own account. Like every other trader on the Chicago exchanges, he saw how much money could be made trading futures contracts in Chicago against the present prices of the individual stocks trading in New York and New Jersey. Every day there were thousands of moments when the prices were out of whack, when, for instance, you could sell the futures contract for more than the price of the stocks that comprised it. To capture the profits, you had to be fast to both markets at once. What was meant by fast was changing rapidly. In the old days, before, say, 2007, the speed with which a trader could execute had human limits. Human beings worked on the floors of the exchanges, and if you wanted to buy or sell anything, you had to pass through them. The exchanges by 2007 were simply stacks of computers in data centers. The speed with which trades occurred on them was no longer constrained by people. The only constraint was how fast an electronic signal could travel between Chicago and New York, or, more precisely, between the data center in Chicago that housed the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and a data center beside the NASDAQ Stock Exchange in Carteret, New Jersey.
That was Flash Boys by Michael Lewis. Dave Barry, professional humorist, and the man whose unique worldview will keep you in stitches, is just out with a new title. You Can Date Boys When You're 40. Dave Barry on parenting and other topics he knows very little about. We'll be speaking with Dave today about this new title. For many years, Dave wrote a newspaper column that appeared in more than 500 newspapers and which earned him a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Barry has written more than 30 books, including the novels Big Trouble, Lunatics, Tricky Business, and most recently, Insane City. He's also written a number of books with titles like I'll Mature When I'm Dead, which are technically classified as nonfiction, although, according to the author, they contain numerous lies. Welcome, Dave. It's an honor to have you back with us on the Book Report.
It's an honor to be back on the Book Report.
First and foremost, I have to be serious. I live with a guy who's not prone to spontaneous outbursts of laughter. But this man laughed out loud about every minute and a half while reading your book, so kudos to you.
He sounds like he's a sick man.
Okay, one more serious note and then we'll get on with it. Has your daughter Sophie ever recovered from Justin Bieber not attending her bat mitzvah party?
No. I mean, not in the sense of, forgiving him, but she stopped loving him not long after that we went to this concert. If only she'd stopped before we spent several $100,000 on tickets to go see Justin Bieber, that would have been better. But after we went to this concert here in Miami, at which she did throw her bat mitzvah invitation at his feet, literally, she decided he was a jerk. And so we're all glad he didn't come to the bat mitzvah.
Yeah, I think most of us have decided that he's a jerk.
Yes, apparently he's the only person left on the face of the earth who doesn't realize that.
Okay, in the prologue to You Can Date Boys When You're 40, you talk about judging a book by its cover.
Yes. The title of the book does suggest, and the cover of the book does suggest, that this is a book about parenting, because it's called You Can Date Boys When You're 40, which is a statement I have made to my daughter more than once. She's now 14, so she's got 26 years to go before she can date. And I'll probably be dead when that happens, but I still plan to go along in an urn.
Oh.
And it'll say on the side, "You kids have fun, pay no attention to me," something like that. but in fact, the book is not about parenting, even though that's what the cover would suggest. That essay is, but it's actually a series of essays on a variety of topics. I hope people realize that whatever they want, to find. Whatever the topic is they're interested in, it's in this book.
Absolutely. And I want to tell readers, there's a great bit of historical research in your book. For example, you've uncovered the fact that no country where the masculine population wears capri pants has ever won a war.
That's correct. Yeah, I have an essay in there about manliness, how to be a man. And one of the things I say is you can't wear capri pants, even though the fashion industry, really the New York Times fashion section, decides about once every 6 months, it gets a bee in its bonnet, that capri pants are going to be in for men. And they even show photos of men wearing capri pants. Of course, these men are always models, and they don't look happy about it. They have that kind of grim model look on their face. They're being paid to wear the damn capri pants. But to the argument that, well, there are countries where men do wear capri pants, now I answered, as you say, that yes, but none of those countries has ever won a war.
Yeah, I saw three guys wearing capri pants near my home on Miami Beach. So, Dave, is it time to put the condo on the market?
They were from Europe. Or they were New Yorkers who read the New York Times fashion section and take it seriously. There's about maybe, I would say, 2 to 3 dozen men in the nation who do what the New York Times fashion section says men are going to do. The rest of us don't. We continue to buy our clothes at Target.
Okay. Interestingly, there's a section of the book dealing with grammar and formulating a correct grammatical sentence. And you even delve into predicates, a term which most of us have heard before, but few can explain. Why grammar? Why now?
On grammar is actually based on a weekly newspaper humor column. I used to write a pretty regularly column called Ask Mr. Language Person, in which I would pretend to be an expert on language named Mr. Language Person. And the running joke was that the advice I gave was horrendously wrong. It was always completely the opposite of the truth. What used to get me about it was that column would run, the column would typically have 50 incorrect statements about grammar. And then I would get, people would write me, often English teachers, and say, I suppose you're not aware that when you're passing yourself as a language expert, you have actually made some, and they'll circled 2 of the 50 errors, having missed the other 48. So, yes, I wrote an essay on grammar, which usually people don't think of as a humor topic, but which I find pretty funny.
Yeah. Is texting the death knell of the English language?
I don't know. I mean, my daughter communicates primarily by texting. I think that if she could, she would text me even when I'm standing next to her. Does she want waffles or Fruit Loops this morning? But it certainly has changed the way people use the language. And not for the better in some ways. I mean, the spelling of texting is not acceptable. So I hope that young people figure out that they can't write that way when they're writing their job applications. But maybe they haven't. I don't know.
Yeah. You throw around some pretty heady vocabulary. For example, what is arthropodic?
I don't know. No, I make up grammar terms, I'll say, this is a marsupial phrase, that kind of thing.
I see. Okay, there's a section in the book about travel with a focus on the TSA. As one of America's funniest guys, have you ever actually joked with TSA personnel, and can you share the outcome?
Well, I came close. I have a section in here about how to take a plane, and one of the things I discuss in there is they say you're not allowed to make inappropriate jokes around the TSA. And so I have a little chart in the book, which I call the official Transportation Security Administration Checkpoint Humor Guidelines, giving inappropriate and appropriate jokes. For example, inappropriate would be, I have a bomb in my backpack. That's an inappropriate joke. An appropriate version would be, I have a bomb in my backpack. Ha ha, I am just joking around with you in an appropriate manner. Then they'll let you right through, no problem. I did once in the Miami International Airport, when they had first installed these new scanners they have that scan an image of your naked body and then send it to a TSA agent in another room, or Facebook. We don't actually know what they do with that naked image. But the first time I went through that at Miami International Airport, they stopped me and they wouldn't let me through. They put me in this little holding area, and I asked the guy, after several minutes went by. I said, "Can you tell me what this is about?" And he said, "Yeah, you have a blurred groin."
Oh,
and that's not something you want to find out at the airport.
No. Okay, I want to share this line with listeners, which references your inability to bargain while shopping in the Middle East. To quote you, "I come from a long line of WASPs. Our tradition is to pay full price, then get revenge by starting an exclusive country club."
My family's WASP. We don't have a tradition of bargaining. My bargaining status is usually to say, like, I mean, my tactic is usually to say, "Are you sure you're making enough money on this deal?" I'm just not good at it. And one of the essays in the book where that the bargaining comes up is my wife and daughter and I went to Israel in last summer, and for a trip with a temple, and I bought some sandals, the cheap rubber sandals, like water shoes, in Tel Aviv from this guy, this like street merchant, and it said, all the guidebooks said, you are supposed to bargain. And I just couldn't bring myself to do it because I figured out that they were, you know, like $8. And that just seemed fine to me. Obviously, I'm supposed to get him down to like $3 or something like that. But I just went and paid the $8. And then when I got back to the hotel, I realized that first of all, he had charged me $8 per sandal, it turned out. I didn't realize that right away because the unit of currency in Israel is shekels, believe it or not. Which I thought was a joke, but it really is what they use. And the other thing is... not only did he charge me, $8 per sandal, but they were defective sandals. So I probably should have bargained.
Yeah. Well, I hope you didn't wear them when you went rappelling down the perilous cliff.
Yeah. One of the things I did a number of things in Israel. I was terrified to go there because you hear the Middle East is scary and there's wars and there's tension, and actually none of that was a problem. I mean, we saw no violence. We were fine. But I ended up getting terrified several times. One was riding a camel, which is a scary experience. One was rappelling down a cliff. And I thought, it was on the list of activities, and I didn't really want to do it because I'm afraid of heights. But my daughter wanted to do it. You can't, if you're a dad, tell your, she was then 13-year-old daughter, "No, we can't do this because I'm afraid," when she's all hot to do it. I thought there would be some kind of, concession where they would have safety nets and legal disclaimers that you sign and a staff, and they would show you a little safety video or something before they let you go off this cliff, because it was a real cliff. I mean, it was not it was way down there. It was like the Grand Canyon, and instead it's like one guy standing there on the edge of the cliff, really too close to the edge if you ask me, and he's got this like ring bolted into the cliff. I don't know who bolted it in or how long ago, and he just basically he puts his harness on you and says, "Okay, go," and you just like, walk backwards off the cliff. Which, and the rabbi of the temple, Rabbi Edwin Goldberg, was with us, was our guy, sort of our guy. And he went first, and he was down there, and I'm dangling over him, and I'm thinking, I wonder if it's like some kind of real serious major violation of the law in Israel to poop on rabbi. Because I was in close. That was danger of losing total sphincter control up there.
I don't blame you, but I want to let the listeners know that the book includes a photo of your rappelling adventure.
Because people might not believe that I actually would do such a thing, but I did, and you can see in the book a picture of me taken by a trained ophthalmologist, I'll have you know, also on the trip, dangling on the side of this cliff, absolutely terrified.
But you did it, and that's what counts.
I did it. I photographic proof in the book.
Right. So, Dave, what's next? What are you working on now?
I just finished a young adult fiction book for Disney called The Worst, well, at least tentatively called The Worst Class Trip Ever.
Oh.
It's about a class trip that goes severely wrong. And then I'm working on another essay book because I had a bunch more ideas, so.
All right. Well, I think you'll have to go a long way to top this one. This was amazingly funny. Readers, you got to pick it up. Thank you, Dave. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure, Elaine. Thank you.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sample of You Can Date Boys When You're 40, Dave Barry on parenting and other topics he knows very little about, performed by Mr. Barry himself.
That's why my original idea was to give the book a more vague and general title. Here are some of the titles I submitted to the publisher. Dave Barry's Vague General Book of Humor Topics. Dave Barry's Guide to Whatever This Book Is About. Dave Barry, a Dave Barry book by Dave Barry. Dave Barry, you probably thought he was dead. But the marketing people wanted something more specific, and they liked the idea of a title that was about family and or parenting. So after rejecting several more of my suggestions, including, without family, we would have nothing except way more money and spare time, they went with the current title, You Can Date Boys When You're 40. Those words do appear in one of the essays in this book, and they are words that I have actually said to my daughter, Sophie. As I write this, Sophie is 13 years old, which, as you veteran parents of daughters know, is a terrifying age because of puberty. Girls do not go through puberty the way boys do. For boys, puberty is a gradual process. It took me decades, and it's not all that drastic. When the boy is done undergoing puberty, he's hairier and smellier, but still basically the same. Female puberty is a whole different kettle of biological fish. For years, my daughter was this sweet, innocent little girl who played with dolls, slept with stuffed animals, and viewed me as a wise authority figure because of all the amazing things I knew how to do, such as tell time. Then one day at about 4:30 in the afternoon, Sophie went into her bathroom, which is pink, and whoom, some kind of massive hormone bomb went off in there. She emerged maybe 45 minutes later, having aged, biologically, at least 7 years. Suddenly she was this woman, with legs and everything, walking around. The same thing happened pretty much simultaneously to all her friends. All of them were suddenly beautiful, feminine, poised, sophisticated, and several linear feet taller than the boys their age. The day the hormone bomb detonated marked the end of the era wherein my daughter viewed me as an authority. These days, pretty much the only time she turns to me for guidance is when she can't find the Cinnamon Toast Crunch. When she needs to discuss anything more important, school, relationships, hair, clothes, makeup, hair accessories, and biological matters I don't even want to think about, she confers with her several hundred closest girlfriends, or my wife, who is also a woman. I am way out of the loop. I don't even know where the loop is. Nevertheless, I am legally Sophie's father, and I have certain fundamental obligations, the main one being to protect her from harm, with harm defined as men. As a lifelong male myself, I am well aware of the way we think, and I don't want anybody thinking things like that within a 1,000-yard radius of my daughter. The problem I am facing right now is boys, which biologically are nothing more than short men. My daughter's school is infested with them. Lately, they have taken to hanging around our house, darting around out there on bicycles and skateboards, and trying to act as though they are not thinking about what they are thinking about, which we all know is exactly what they are thinking about. Here's what really bothers me. Sometimes they get inside the house. I blame my wife. If it were up to me, our house would be surrounded by giant but humane traps baited with some kind of bait that would be attractive to 13-year-old boys, such as fireworks or shorts that are even baggier than the shorts they're already wearing. Every now and then we'd hear the loud thwonk of a steel door slamming shut, indicating that a 13-year-old boy had come too close to the house. I would then go outside and, after a stern warning, drive the boy out to the Everglades and release him into the wild. But my wife allows them to come in. She has never been a 13-year-old boy, so she thinks it's okay if sometimes one of them watches TV with Sophie, the two of them eating popcorn and sitting in the family room on the exact same sofa. If it were up to me, I would insist that the boy had to sit on an entirely separate piece of furniture, which would be located in Iceland. But because of my wife's naive soft-heartedness, we have this potentially catastrophic situation that requires me to casually stroll past the family room every 8 to 10 seconds, back and forth and back and forth, a dad on patrol, each time casually glancing inside to make sure nothing is happening. I'm thinking of getting some kind of firearm, which every now and then I would casually discharge into the family room ceiling. Ha ha! That will give Mr. Short Man something to think about. Only 27 more years to go.
We've just heard You Can Date Boys When You're 40 by Dave Barry. From politics to the personal, fashion to food, the campus to the locker room, the desire to be cool infects all aspects of our lives. The cool are the termites of life, infiltrating every nook and cranny, and oft-times destroying it from within. The cool report the news, write the scripts, teach our children, and run our government. Each day they pass judgment on those who don't worship their coolness. They are, in short, awful people. In Not Cool, the Hipster Elite and Their War on You, Greg Gutfeld lays out the battle plan for reclaiming the real American ideal of cool, building businesses, protecting freedom at home and abroad, taking responsibility for your actions, and leaving other people to live as they please. Not Cool fights back against the culture of phonies, elitists, and creeps who want your soul. Steve Kramer narrates.
I won't pretend to understand how this works. As an English major, I have no discernible skills other than spelling discernible correctly. But I know this, that because this company happened to be Facebook, the story was a one-day affair. It came and went like an ice cream headache, leaving neither a bruise nor a hickey on the Zuckerberg empire. If this company were something that actually made something in a factory or field, it would be roundly condemned by every single media hack on the planet. Case in point, we have a strident administration that rails against oil companies constantly while taking credit for its record-breaking output, and the rich in general over their perceived failure to pay their fair share. Both entities are evil, for they make stuff people want, and because of this, they make a mountain of money. And from that mountain of money, the government takes a hefty slice, which bureaucrats then spend on extremely important stuff, like a study into why lesbians tend to be overweight. I could have answered that question. It's called pastry. At one point, back in February, on Al Sharpton's show, I believe it's on MSNBC, a network for grad students suffering from shingles, President Obama made a petulant observation that what unites the Republican Party is protecting the rich from having their taxes raised. Well then, what about your friends at Google, Twitter, and Facebook, Mr. President? Don't they have to pay their fair share? If Obama got any more adolescent, I'd have to ground him for a week and take away his Twitter privileges. No more selfies at memorial services for world leaders. And so, fossil fuels, a boring, banal, greasy, dirty, evil thing that is used by everyone, especially the poor, minorities, and women, are trashed daily by our commander-in-chief. Meanwhile, a social networking tool, built by a social networking tool, that monopolizes the time of schoolgirls and the fat pervs who befriend them, gets off scot-free. Why is this important? Because one item produces energy while the other steals it. Without oil, we'd be nowhere. With Facebook, we are nowhere. Facebook has become the anti-oil, the anti-energy phantom that steals time and effort from everyone under the false pretense that you are actually doing something when you're only friending an ex or liking a picture of the ex's hideous children. And make no mistake, if those weren't your kids, you'd think they were ugly too. This is based on my own research finding that everyone thinks their own children are 450% better looking than they really are. This illusion of attractiveness was created by nature to keep parents from strangling offspring when the brats wake you up at 3 a.m. screaming like feces-spraying gremlins. I know. I'm sure that when I have kids, I will think they're adorable too, before I leave them in the forest chained to a tree. We live in a time when the industry we need most is vilified, and the one company that distracts us from reality gets a pass because it's coming from somewhere cool. Silicon Valley, a place where Silicon people live. Seriously, remember that old James Dean flick, Giant? Guys working in oil fields, to me, seemed pretty damn cool. Now they're seen as the problem. Instead, we look to pale, skinny men in hoodies and say, yes, that's cooler. I get the change in culture. I just don't have to like it.
That was a sample of Not Cool by Greg Gutfeld. Adam Braun began working summers at hedge funds when he was just 16, sprinting down the path to a successful Wall Street career. But while traveling in India as a college kid, he met a young boy begging on the streets. When Braun asked the boy what he wanted most in the world, the boy simply answered, a pencil. The small request became the inspiration for Pencils of Promise, the organization Braun started with just $25 at the age of 24. In The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change, Braun helps redefine the space in which business, philanthropy, and social media intersect. 5 years later, Pencils of Promise has built more than 200 schools around the world, proving that anyone can create a movement that matters. Braun chronicles his journey through more than 50 countries to find his calling. His story, performed by Kirby Hayborn, takes listeners behind the scenes with business moguls and village chiefs, celebrities and hometown heroes, and offers listeners tools to take the first step on their own journeys of self-discovery.
My older brother Scott is a typical firstborn son. He loved to challenge my dad's authority. His code word was cream. Mine was ice. And my younger sister Liza was Sunday. If we were all misbehaving, upsetting my mother and about to catch a spanking, my dad just had to yell, "Ice cream Sunday!" And we would stop right away. But as I look back on it, being the guy furiously screaming "Ice cream Sunday" probably didn't help to rid my father of his reputation among my friends of being the scary dad. Even back then, we knew his crazy temper and strict discipline were just forms of tough love. He wanted to get the best from each of us, and he got it. As a coach, no one pushed me harder. He had me play 3 games on the final day of the 14-year-old state championships with a raging fever because he knew how badly I wanted to win the tournament. He'd set up cones in the basement so that after dinner I could do dribbling drills in the dark. But the result was worth it. And when I consider what motivated my siblings and me most, it all boiled down to one phrase that my dad used constantly that gave us the permission and the directive to stand out. He loved to remind us, "Brawns are different." My siblings and I knew that some of the parents in town rewarded their kids for good grades. This could mean up to $100 for an A, $75 for a B, $50 for a C, and so forth. When I asked my parents for some form of compensation for my academic performance, my request was shot down immediately. "Paul Mazza just got $150 for good grades. Can I get something?" I'd ask. "Brawns are different. You have our gratitude," they'd say. During Hanukkah, rather than receiving 8 nights of gifts, we received gifts on only 4 nights, and the alternate 4 nights, we selected a charity that my parents donated to in our names. When we'd ask why half of our Hanukkah gifts were charitable donations instead of presents, my parents would simply respond, "Because brawns are different." Most of our friends had high-tech toys and video games, but my siblings and I were told to go read books or play outside. Our pleas and arguments were always met with the same response, "Brawns are different." My dad didn't think we were superior. He wanted us to hold ourselves to a higher standard. This phrase was not only used to justify my mom and dad's different approach to parenting, but to celebrate us when we displayed courage by taking the path less traveled. If we stood up for a classmate who was being bullied, they would applaud us by saying, "You know why you did that? Because brawns are different." Children want nothing more than their parents' approval, and pretty soon, we developed an inherent drive to live into the ideals they had defined for us. Every night before we went out to parties in middle and high school, my dad would say, "Remember Dad's rules." Dad's rules meant, don't do anything that you wouldn't do if Dad were watching. Choose your actions as if Dad were next to you the whole time. These expectations of excellence became the tent poles that formed our values, and our values then guided the choices we made. They served as a constant reminder that to achieve exceptional things, you must hold yourself to exceptional standards, regardless of what others may think.
That was The Promise of a Pencil by Adam Braun. No matter what you thought of his presidency, I'm sure you'll agree Jimmy Carter has been a formidable statesman. Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power is a title many are calling his most important. Carter, who narrates, describes the world's discrimination and violence against women and girls and a growing tolerance of violence and warfare. Carter draws upon his own experiences and the testimony of courageous women from all regions and all major religions to demonstrate the ways in which women around the world are being denied equal rights.
By 2007, the income of the middle 60% of Americans had increased at a rate twice as high as that of the bottom 20%. And the rate of increase for the top 1% was over 15 times higher, primarily because of the undue influence of wealthy people who invest in elections and later buy greater benefits for themselves in Washington and in state capitals. As the conservative columnist George Will writes, and I quote, "Big government inevitably drives an upward distribution of wealth to those whose wealth, confidence, and sophistication enable them to manipulate government," unquote. Yet although economic disparity is a great and growing problem, I have become convinced that the most serious and unaddressed worldwide challenge is the deprivation and abuse of women and girls, largely caused by a false interpretation of carefully selected religious texts and a growing tolerance of violence and warfare. Unfortunately, following the example set during my lifetime by the United States. In addition to the unconscionable human suffering, almost embarrassing to acknowledge, there's a devastating effect on economic prosperity caused by the loss of contributions of at least half the human beings on Earth. This is not just a women's issue. It is not confined to the poorest countries. It affects us all. After focusing for a few years on the problem of gender discrimination through our human rights program at the Carter Center, I began to speak out more forcefully about it. Because of this, I was asked to address the Parliament of the World's Religions, an audience of several thousand who assembled in Australia in December 2009, about the vital role of religion in providing a foundation for countering the global scourge of gender abuse. My remarks represented the personal views of a Christian layman, a Bible teacher for more than 70 years, a former political leader. I reminded the audience that in dealing with each other, we are guided by international agreements as well as our own moral values, most often derived from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Bible, the Quran, and other cherished texts that proclaim a commitment to justice and mercy, equality of treatment between men and women, and a duty to alleviate suffering. However, some selected scriptures are interpreted almost exclusively by powerful male leaders within the Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, and other faiths to proclaim the lower status of women and girls. This claim that women are inferior before God spreads to the secular world to justify gross and sustained acts of discrimination and violence against them. This includes unpunished rape and other sexual abuse, infanticide of newborn girls and abortion of female fetuses, a worldwide trafficking in women and girls, and so-called honor killings of innocent women who are raped, as well as the less violent but harmful practices of lower pay and fewer promotions for women and greater political advantages for men. I mentioned some notable achievements of women despite these handicaps and describe struggles within my own religious faith. I called on believers, whether Protestant, Catholic, Coptic, Jew, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, or tribal, to study these violations of our basic moral values and to take corrective action. Zaina Anwar, founder of Sisters in Islam in Malaysia, wrote, and I quote, "No matter what our faith may be, it is impossible to imagine a God who is unjust," unquote. I'm about to outline how I learned more and more about these issues as a child, a submarine officer, a farmer, and a church leader during the civil rights struggle, as a governor and a president, as a college professor, and in the global work of the Carter Center. During the 9 decades of my life, I have become increasingly aware of and concerned about the immense number of and largely ignored gender-based crimes. There are reasons for hope that some of these abuses can be ended when they become better known and understood. I hope that this book will help to expose these violations to a broader audience and marshal a more concerted effort to address this profound problem.
That was A Call to Action by Jimmy Carter. Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed in America was one of those books everyone should have read. High school kids, soccer moms, business execs. It's a modern classic that deftly portrays the plight of America's working class poor. Now, Ehrenreich is just out with Living with a Wild God, a non-believer's search for the truth about everything. It's part memoir, part philosophical, and spiritual inquiry. In recent years, Ehrenreich came across the journal she'd kept during her tumultuous adolescence. At the time, she had had a series of uncanny, or as she later called them, mystical experiences. A staunch atheist and rationalist, she became profoundly shaken by the implications of her lifelong search. The book brings an older woman's wry and erudite perspective to a young girl's uninhibited musing on questions that torment us all. The title, performed by the author, is sure to spark a lively and heated conversation about religion and spirituality, science and morality, and the meaning of life.
The folder contains a kind of journal, though it is really only an intermittent series of entries, each on a separate piece of paper, from the years 1956 to 1966, and mostly from the first 3 of those years, starting when I was 14. What impelled me to hold it back from the tomb that was about to swallow all the other paper remnants of my life was the prospect of mortality, though not my own mortality, as a 59-year-old woman with a full, productive life behind her. In fact, if you're not prepared to die when you're almost 60, then I would say you've been falling down on your philosophical responsibilities as a grown-up human being. As for the manner of my death, I would have preferred to start swimming out across the Gulf at dusk, which is shark feeding time, and was still hoping to squeeze that in should the cancer take a turn for the worse. No, what scared me on that clear, breezy spring day was the knowledge that the journal is not a self-explanatory, standalone document. It begins, promisingly enough, on a wry note. Quote, "Today, July 4th, 1956, is a national holiday. That means that people who would normally work elsewhere are now free to work at home. Independence Day is celebrated all over the nation by noisy declarations of disregard for all laws prohibiting firecrackers." Close quote. But too often it is tangled and evasive, especially on some of the most important things, which as a girl I had found too private and too searing to commit to paper. I knew the journal would require a major job of exegesis, a strenuous reconstruction of all that I once thought was better left unsaid. So the sad thing was that if I, the 59-year-old Barbara, died, she died too, the girl who had written these things so long ago. That's who or what I was determined to save, because if I have any core identity, any central theme that has survived all the apparent changes of subject, the secret of it lies with her. I knew, roughly speaking, what was in the journal, and that it records what led up to an event so strange, so cataclysmic, that I never in all the intervening years wrote or spoke about it. I did make an attempt once or twice with someone I was especially close to, only to have them change the subject or look away uneasily. What had happened did not occupy any category that intersected with my central adult concerns, such as making a living and taking care of my family, while at the same time doing what little I could to try to reduce the amount of cruelty in the world. Besides, despite what I like to think of as continual improvements in my ability to express myself, when it came to this one topic, there were no words. It hadn't been until I reached my 40s that I discovered that what had happened to me, or something very similar, has also happened to many other people, and that some of them had even found ways of talking about it, although usually in a vocabulary and framework foreign to me, if not actually repulsive. The conventional term is mystical experience, meaning something that by its very nature lies beyond the reach of language, except for some vague verbal hand-wavings about mystery and transcendence. As far as I was concerned, as a rationalist, an atheist, a scientist by training, this was the realm of gods and fairies, and of no use to the great human project of trying to retain a foothold on the planet for future generations. So what do you do with something like this, an experience so anomalous, so disconnected from the normal life you share with other people, that you can't even figure out how to talk about it? I was also, I have to admit, afraid of sounding crazy. Try inserting an account of a mystical experience into a conversation, and you'll likely get the same response as you would if you confided that you had been the victim of an alien abduction. Both involve encounters with beings whose existence is not universally acknowledged, extraterrestrial beings in the one case, spirits, deities, or some universal being in the other, and in the academic literature, both are subjected to the same sort of clinical condescension.
We've heard a sampling of Living with a Wild God by Barbara Ehrenreich. Arianna Huffington's personal wake-up call came in the form of a broken cheekbone and a nasty gash over her eye, the result of a fall brought on by exhaustion and lack of sleep. The co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post is, by any traditional measure, extraordinarily successful. Yet, as she found herself going from an MRI to a CAT scan to an echocardiogram, all to find out if there was any underlying medical problem beyond exhaustion, she found herself wondering, is this really what success feels like? Thrive, the third metric to redefining success and creating a life of well-being, wisdom, and wonder, is Huffington's passionate call to arms, redefining what success means today. She likens our drive for money and power to two legs of a three-legged stool. It may hold us up temporarily, but sooner or later will topple. We need a third leg, a third metric for defining success. In this deeply personal book performed by Agape Stassinopoulos, Arianna talks candidly about her challenges with managing time and prioritizing the demands of a career and family. She draws on new research in psychology, sports, sleep, and physiology to show the profound and transformative effects of mindfulness, giving, and unplugging.
On the morning of April 6, 2007, I was lying on the floor of my home office in a pool of blood. On my way down, my head had hit the corner of my desk, cutting my eye and breaking my cheekbone. I had collapsed from exhaustion and lack of sleep. In the wake of my collapse, I found myself going from doctor to doctor, from brain MRI to CAT scan, to echocardiogram, to find out if there was any underlying medical problem beyond exhaustion. There wasn't. But doctors' waiting rooms, it turns out, were good places for me to ask myself a lot of questions about the kind of life I was living. We founded the Huffington Post in 2005, and 2 years in, we were growing at an incredible pace. I was on the cover of magazines and had been chosen by Time as one of the world's 100 most influential people. But after my fall, I had to ask myself, was this what success looked like? Was this the life I wanted? I was working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, trying to build a business, expand our coverage, and bring in investors. But my life, I realized, was out of control. In terms of the traditional measures of success, which focus on money and power, I was very successful. But I was not living a successful life by any sane definition of success. I knew something had to radically change. I could not go on that way. This was a classic wake-up call. Looking back on my life, I had other times when I should have woken up, but didn't. This time I really did, and made many changes in the way I live my life, including adopting daily practices to keep me on track and out of doctors' waiting rooms. The result is a more fulfilling life, one that gives me breathing spaces and a deeper perspective. This book was conceived as I tried to pull together all the insights I had gleaned about my work and life during the weeks I spent writing the commencement speech I was to give to the class of 2013 at Smith College. With two daughters in college, I take commencement speeches very seriously. It's such a special moment for the graduating class, a pause, a kind of parenthesis in time, following 4 or 5 or 6 years of non-stop learning and growing, just before the start of an adult life spent moving forward and putting all of that knowledge into action. It's a unique marker in their lives. And for 15 minutes or so, I have the graduates' undivided attention. The challenge is to say something equal to the occasion, something that will be useful during a charged time of new beginnings. Commencement speakers, I told the women graduates, are traditionally expected to tell the graduating class how to go out there and climb the ladder of success. But I want to ask you instead to redefine success. Because the world you are headed into desperately needs it, and because you are up to the challenge. Your education at Smith has made it unequivocally clear that you are entitled to take your place in the world wherever you want that place to be. You can work in any field, and you can make it to the top of any field. But what I urge you to do is not just take your place at the top of the world, but to change the world.
That was Thrive by Arianna Huffington. Readers in the genre of new nonfiction, I trust you found we've covered all the bases today. There's a wealth of new titles out there now. Your challenge is to decide which to choose. I hope today's show has helped a bit, but if fiction is more your game, check my website, bookreportradio.com. I'll keep you updated on what's new and notable. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.